So today we're going to deal with two big ideas that are, which I'll present in fairly stylized ways to kind of strip them down to their central core, but which are actually ideas that have can be deployed in the analysis of class conflict in all sorts of contexts where the strict conditions of this relatively simple, straightforward analysis don't apply. These two ideas can be captured in two theses, which are stated at the top of the outline. They can be called the class compromise thesis and the transition cost thesis. These two, taken together, are meant to provide some core insights into why, under conditions of developed capitalism, class conflict exists everywhere, but it exists in very contained ways. Contained ways within production and contained ways within the society at large in the state. And broadly, in contained ways that, in a kind of loose way, are referred to as reformism. Remember, this whole set of discussions began with the kind of simple puzzle that's posed interior to the Marxist tradition. It's not a puzzle for every theoretical tradition, but it's a puzzle inside of Marxism. If capitalism is nasty as the theory says it is, if class structures have these tendencies and are founded on this polarized antagonism between exploiters and exploited, oppressors and oppressed, dominant classes and subordinated classes, or more precisely, capitalists and workers, if this is a correct diagnosis of the nature of this kind of social order, why is it so stable? Why are struggles so tame? Why do they just nibble around the edges? Why don't we see revolutionary challenges more frequently? And indeed, in the developed capitalist world, the big puzzle is not that we don't see them frequently, we don't see them at all. There has never been in a developed capitalist country a revolutionary challenge to the dominance of capitalism. Now that's a puzzle if your theoretical framework for how to understand the society is rooted in this account of antagonistic relations. The question then is it a puzzle which you can resolve without just sort of arbitrary patches? Or is it a puzzle which the theory itself can help us understand? And that's where I think the ideas of both class compromise and transition costs figure in today's lecture. And it's where the analysis of the organizational logics of opportunism played a role in the last lecture, the offa position. So let me briefly state by introduction these two theses, the class compromise thesis and the transition cost thesis, and then I will talk about each of them. And we will indeed have plenty of time. I'll do this in a condensed way, so we'll have plenty of time for freewheeling discussion around these themes. First, then, the class compromise thesis. Under certain conditions, if workers and capitalists act rationally in the pursuit of economic interests, then they will converge on a class compromise form of class conflict in which capitalists agree to return part of the fruits of accumulation to workers in the form of productivity-based wage increases, and workers agree to moderate their wage demands to a level which does not threaten the rate of profit, and to cooperate with capital in the labor process. So that's a class compromise. When workers agree to withhold their maximum militancy and capitalists agree to provide for some benefits to workers as a result of improvements in productivity. Understood in this way, a class compromise is not simply a stalemate. It's not just a balance of forces on the battleground. That's what I refer to as a negative class compromise. Rather, it's a situation in which there is some positive gains from cooperation for both workers and capitalists. And that's why I refer to that as a positive class compromise. So the first thesis is that positive class compromises are possible. They may be robust and system-wide. They may be partial and located within particular settings. They may be relatively micro, so you can have class compromises within particular firms. Or they may be more macro and institutionalized. So there's a lot of variation. And the readings don't really discuss that aspect. I think that's a weakness both of Shaworsky's account and my own extension of Shaworsky. But I think that's how one should think about it. The transition cost thesis then says, once a class compromise is reached, and I think that's how I formulated it in things I've written about it. I think in a way the transition cost thesis does not really depend on the class compromise thesis, but I'll state it as if they were interdependent. You'll see why that's a point in later. Once a class compromise is reached, then the transitions cost involved in a socialist rupture will always be sufficiently high to make it economically irrational for workers individually and collectively to struggle for socialism. The struggle for socialism can only be based on non-economic criteria. If you struggle for socialism because of the economic promise that it provides, it will never be rational to struggle for it under conditions where class compromise, even a weak class compromise, is possible. This is a pessimistic view about the possibility of socialism. It comes from a belief that the pessimism comes from the belief that these non-economic criteria, bases for struggling for socialism, are unlikely to be sufficiently strong to sustain a transformation towards any socialist alternative. If the transformation process is ruptural. So the transition cost thesis is not a claim about the impossibility of transformation. It's a claim about the impossibility of ruptural transformation, that you cannot have transition between systems, or it's at least extremely unlikely, if the motivation for the transformation is going to be improvement of material conditions of life. You could have a ruptural transformation if other motivations were central, but they are unlikely to be strong enough to survive the transition. So we'll explain reasoning behind that in a moment. Okay, so let's pretty rapidly go through each of these. First, the conditions for class compromise. Shaworsky's basic argument is grounded in what might be thought of as the fundamental fact of capitalism. So there's a kind of big thesis. This is a fundamental fact with a capital F. This is a truth about capitalism. Economic growth and innovation comes out of private profits. That's the kind of world we live in, that economic growth is the result of the willingness of private owners of capital to invest their capital in new means of production and expanded production and innovation. That's where you get economic growth, from privately motivated accumulation. Now, of course, that's a slight oversimplification. State investments in infrastructure is crucial for economic growth. We know that state-led development plays an important role, but nevertheless, as a broad claim about what's distinctive about capitalism is that economic growth and innovation is really driven by private profits and the willingness of capitalists to devote their private profits to that purpose. This has really profound implications for the nature of working class formations and their strategies for struggle. This can be summarized in kind of four claims. First, workers' present welfare, how well off workers are going to be in the present, depends upon two primary factors: the existing level of productivity, in the economy in which they are working, and their ability to resist exploitation. Those two together really do explain workers' current welfare. The first of these explains how much is produced for any given amount of labor inputs, and the second explains what portion of the total product workers are able to retain as wages and what part gets appropriated from them as surplus. So that's a kind of simple static equation. If you know the level of productivity and you know the capacity to resist exploitation, you'll know the standards of living of workers. Workers' future welfare, not their present welfare, but their future welfare, depends upon also two processes. Capitalists' present investments out of the surplus they appropriate, and workers' capacity to appropriate future streams of wages from productivity growth. That's what determines the future well-being of workers. Now, the key issue is that one of these elements workers have no control over. So workers do have some control over their ability to resist exploitation. That's the result of their collective action, their individual capacities to resist, all sorts of things that enable workers to resist. That's a decision variable that they make. Now, it's not that they make it autonomously. Of course, they're under constraints, but they can decide a lot about two. They can't really decide about three. That's what private ownership means. Capitalists decide how much to invest out of the present surplus. And that's the problem with respect to number four. And this creates a dilemma. Workers can't maximize both number two and number three. You can't do both. That is, if you maximize number two, it impinges on number three. There's a relationship between these two, right? The more you resist exploitation successfully, you reduce the amount of surplus available to capitalists, and you reduce the potential that capitalists could invest for future growth. This generates a tension within the working class, since workers face this trade-off between the present and the future. Now, in one sense, this is a ordinary humdrum trade-off. That is, in your own personal life, you face a trade-off between present and future consumption. If your future consumption depends at all upon your savings, right? So this is a kind of simple individual time discount problem, to use the economist's language. You have a certain income today. Your future income is going to depend upon two things: how much you save out of your present income, and what your future income stream is. These are these two things. One thing you can do with what you save out of your current income is invested in human capital. Right? So that's the kind of individual level equivalent of 1, 2, 3, and 4 on here. Right? So you're the capitalist of your own savings, so to speak. You can invest it in human capital. But in the individual case, you are making the decisions on each of those. So you are deciding the trade-off between what you're going to consume now, what you're going to save now, and how much of what you save you're going to invest to increase your future stream of income. And of course, there's uncertainty and there's risks, but you are directly engaged in each of those decision points. In the class conflict context, it's different agents that have the central power around different elements of these. And that's what makes this, of course, interesting from an intellectual point of view and very difficult and problematic from a human point of view. Yeah, Kate.
But the dilemma is that workers can't maximize both 2 and 3, that it's only because it's two different actors, the workers and the capitalists. It's nothing else, because workers, if they had complete control, they could kind of do an optimization of two variables.
Well, they couldn't maximize both 2 and 3. That is, what they would want to do, if they wanted to maximize how much the present investment is, they wouldn't maximize their current consumption.
They would maximize present net value of future.
Right, right. So they would still be doing it, they would still be engaged in a trade-off between two and three, but they'd be in control of the terms of the trade-off. The problem here, the problem in the capitalist case is in order to get capitalists to invest for the future, capitalists have to believe that they're going to make profits off of those investments. And if workers threaten to appropriate all of the surplus, capitalists aren't going to make those investments because there wouldn't be any incentive for them to. So workers can't, because they don't make the third, they have to trust that capitalists are going to provide for four. They can't ensure that. There is a hand over here.
You answered it.
Okay. Yeah.
What about past surplus? So like there's past surplus, the present surplus that's being resisted by exploitation, and then there's future surplus.
Well,
so the workers can't really control the past surplus.
Well, nobody controls the past surplus. It's just whatever it was.
But don't the capitalists control it because it's in their bank accounts or it's in their stock or it's in their...
Its past surplus has already been invested, so it's embodied in the current level of productivity. And in the it's embodied in the production process, which is represented by two. Capitalists' present investments out of the surplus they appropriate. That's the surplus they appropriate now and in the immediate past. It's true that if capitalists have a pile of surplus that they've put under their pillow for 20 years, it would also affect current investment. But the assumption here is that capitalists are either investing or consuming the surplus. They're not parking the surplus for some future account. They're either investing it or consuming it. Now, of course, that's a simplification. I don't think it's a simplification that harms the argument. The fact that there's some surplus which is carried over that is neither invested nor consumed, it just sits there, just gives capitalists some additional flexibility as to what they're going to do, but it doesn't affect the logic of the dilemmas here. The logic of the dilemmas are that those decisions are made by capitalists and not by workers, but workers have a stake in what those decisions are. So, as I said, you know, this dilemma in the class context is like the perpetual trade-off that everybody faces of present consumption and future consumption, present consumption savings and future consumption. Everybody faces that trade-off. But it has this added problem of struggle and uncertainty, that different agents are under control over different components of this decision process. So let us suppose that workers are insufficiently powerful to overthrow capitalism in their lifetime. They know that. It's just not possible. You're going to be in capitalism. They are powerful enough that they could win very large wage increases through their struggles. Now, that's not true at the present moment, but it has been true at various times in the history of capitalism. Workers can appropriate quite a lot of surplus. They can put a lot of constraint on capital. Would it be rational for them to do so? That if workers are powerful enough to put a wage squeeze on capitalist profits because they have sufficient strength that they can push their wages up, is it rational for them to do so? Should they? Shavorsky's answer is that the rationality of particular wage strategies depends upon the likely response of capitalists to different levels of militancy. And this leads to this particular kind of analysis that Shavorsky argues for, which is pretty distinctive. I think Shavorsky's the... It's not that nobody said some of this stuff before, but he has really laid it out in the clearest way. We can define the following types of kinds of militancy. Optimal militancy is that level of militancy which generates the maximum sustainable positive trajectory of wages over time, assuming that we're staying in capitalism. So the optimal militancy is whatever the level is that produces a sustainable positive trajectory of wages. Maximal militancy is the maximum achievable level of struggle against capital at any given point in time. So let us suppose that no class compromise is possible, either because the economic conditions don't allow it or because the capitalist class is so selfish and short-sighted that they won't ever make a deal with workers. They prefer all-out class war. Under such conditions, if capitalists are engaged in all-out class war, Shavorsky argues, workers will do better by being maximally militant, by trying to obtain the best wages they can at every point in time. That's the best workers can do. If they accept anything less than that, they're going to be even worse off. The hyper-radicalism thesis, one could say, is that optimal militancy is always maximal militancy. So there is a kind of current on the left which says workers should always be as militant as they can get away with. They should never hold back. That you should always get the highest wages you can get. And collective organization of workers should always be organized around that thesis. That they're always in a situation of all-out class war. And to withhold your capacity for struggle is always to the disadvantage of workers. The class compromise thesis says that under certain conditions, optimal militancy will be less intense than maximal militancy. A class compromise means that in exchange for workers moderating their militancy, capitalists agree to reinvest part of the surplus and to give workers some of the fruits of this reinvestment in the form of productivity-based wage increases. That's what capitalists promise in return. Under such conditions, Shavorsky argues, the optimal strategy for workers is to be moderately militant, sufficiently militant to ensure that capitalists abide to their side of the bargain, but not so militant as to threaten the compromise by squeezing the rate of profit. Now, this argument was developed in the 1980s. I think the book is published in 1985, so the elements were published in the late 70s and 80s. This was after the experience of the stagnation of the 70s, which many people felt was the result of a wage squeeze on profits that had occurred because of excessive wage demands in the 60s. That is, there was a general very tight labor markets with strong unions in the 60s, in which wages rose in ways that many people felt put a squeeze on profits. This is essentially part of David Harvey's argument, and that the counteroffensive of capital in the face of that wage squeeze was very disabling for working class associations subsequently. The counterfactual argument then was that it would have been better in the context of the threat of wage squeeze for workers to have moderated through their collective association wage demands rather than to have tried to push their wage demands maximally. In those places where working class power was able to moderate wage demands, to restrain wages, unions remained strong much longer than in those areas where they didn't. So in Northern Europe, Swedish unions acted as forces of wage restraint rather than wage maximization, whereas in less coordinated and sort of cohesive labor movements, workers did not restrain wages in those periods where they could have. And that's the context in which Shavorsky is developing these ideas about moderate militancy being better than maximum militancy. With respect to the long-term stability of the connection between working class wages and productivity increases, that with moderate militancy, it's possible to forge these compromises where workers get long-term wage increases tied to productivity. With maximum militancy, workers maximize it at a given point in time, but they unhinge the connection between productivity growth and wage growth. And when the capitalist class is able to mobilize effectively against collective organization of workers, it leads to a, it can lead to a collapse of working class power itself. So what are the conditions? So that's the setup of Szaborski's argument. He argues that there are three key conditions for this kind of class compromise process to work. They center on the time horizons of actors, the problem of trust, and working class associational power. So let me just briefly explain what each of these are. First, time horizons. This basically concerns how far into the future workers and capitalists make strategic calculations. The higher the degree of uncertainty about the future, the shorter the time horizons of all actors. So time horizons is a general idea. It refers to how far into the future you're prepared to make decisions today. If you believe the future is going to be very much like it is today, that the kind of trade-offs and parameters are pretty much stable into the future, then you're able to plan quite far into the future. If you think that everything is completely uncertain, unpredictable, there's no way to know what's going to happen, it makes it much harder to mobilize present decisions for future possibilities. So the time horizon shrinks. And one of the conditions for class compromises is that actors have reasonably long-term time horizons. In general, in advanced industrial capitalism, actors have had pretty long time horizons, all things considered, because in the sense that they anticipate that capitalism is going to remain in place into the future, they don't feel as much uncertainty about that, so they know they're going to be playing the same general game. And they feel that the character of the economic environment is not going to be fundamentally different 10, 20 years from now than it was in the present. Again, that was written, that view about time horizons in Szaborski's case was written in the early 80s after 30 years of globalization and financialization and volatility. Perhaps less true today, although I think it's still, you know, it's still the case that people believe 20 years from now we will be pretty much still in a globalized capitalism with large financial institutions and high-tech productivity. You know, I don't know the extent to which we've moved from a regime of sufficiently long time horizons under which you can make anticipations about the future to one in which people feel anything goes. It's easy to overstate the changes that have occurred. But nevertheless, it's certainly the case there's more uncertainty about what the future holds. Uncertainty is different from just saying people are more pessimistic. Pessimistic can be not uncertain. It can be that you now believe we're in an era of prolonged stagnation where it's going to be pretty much like it is now, but meaning pretty much like it is now. Things aren't going to get much better. Well, that's not a question of uncertainty. That's just pessimism. Second, trust. Szaborski probably, I think, says that trust is even more important than time horizons. You know, so even if people believe they can predict pretty well future states, they're unlikely to be comfortable with class compromise in which they make major concessions now for future gains if they don't trust the willingness of capitalists, or the capitalists don't trust the willingness of workers to abide by those promises for the future. The historical memory of betrayals can be a serious obstacle to forging class compromises. Because they have antagonistic interests, you know, so you're asking for trust between categories of people whose interests are opposed to each other, it's unlikely that this kind of trust can simply be based on beliefs of good faith. Institutions play a key role, therefore, in making trust possible. This is, as we'll see when we look at Szaborski's analysis of democracy, where he sees the key role for liberal democracy, that democracy is essentially a way in which you can create bargains in which people are held accountable for the bargains they make. And particularly when you have democracy combined with social democratic parties, you're likely to be able to create the conditions for trust. The conditions for trust in places like Sweden, trust between labor and capital, is not because workers were convinced that capitalists had their well-being at heart. So it wasn't trust based on a view of the benevolence of Swedish capital. It was trust based on the fact, on the belief that Swedish capitalists were embedded in Swedish social democracy, and therefore they could be held accountable for the bargains and compacts that were forged. It's the accountability that institutions provide that reinforce the notion that, yes, when you make a deal about future states and present restraints, that those deals would be held up. If these situations occur, then in advanced industrial capitalist democracies, there will in general, or at least in many cases, be sufficiently long time horizons and institutional conditions for class compromises to be forged between capital and labor. Under these conditions, then, workers will be better off if they act in moderately militant ways, and capitalists will be better off if they agree to productivity-connected wage increases. Then either category would be if they each try to maximize their gains at every point in time. Both benefit from these arrangements relative to historically feasible alternatives, if those conditions are present. And finally, this analysis suggests a particular connection between associational power and the possibility of class compromise. This is the part of the argument that I've developed in my paper on class compromise, which I think was also assigned here. The conventional Marxist wisdom is that the relationship between working class power and capitalist interest is inverse. The stronger our workers, the worse off for capitalists, that there's a negative inverse relationship between them. The class compromise thesis indicates that the relationship is more like an inverse J. Capitalists prefer disorganized workers. That's the best situation for capital. But if working class associational power moves beyond that trough in the curve, then capitalists actually develop an interest in stabilizing higher levels of working class power rather than opposing it. This is because working class power, both within production and within the market, so there's different arenas in which working class power can exist, can help capitalists solve certain kinds of problems, and in particular can help improve the way in which workers collaborate with capitalists within production to generate productivity and a social surplus. Capitalists then have interests, or at least the way to put it is their interests in continually opposing working class power decline if working class power moves into that upward sloping part of the curve. In my analysis of associational power and the interests of capital, I argued that in the U.S., because of a variety of reasons, the level of associational power of workers was still in the downward sloping part of the curve, and in Sweden it was in the upward sloping part of the curve, which explains why working class power is always on the defensive in the U.S., and why class compromises are more fragile and partial and tend to be local rather than global in the U.S., whereas in social democratic countries, they're more robust and they tend to be more macro and generalized in the society as a whole. And that has to do with the shape of that curve and where different national class formations are located. That's the central structure of the class compromise thesis. Okay, let me briefly talk about the transition cost thesis. And then we can take our break and have a discussion of how the two fit together. The class compromise thesis is premised on the idea that we're stuck in the game of capitalism. So the whole premise is we're going to be in capitalism, you know, fellow workers. There's no way we're going to overcome capitalism. What's the best thing? What are our best strategies? What are our best strategies given that we're stuck in capitalism? Well, if we're stuck in capitalism, we have to figure out how can we gain enough power to force a deal with capitalists, because after all, our future well-being depends upon what they do. We can't decide what they do. They decide what they do. We need to be strong enough to create terms of a deal in which they agree to invest part of the surplus in jobs and productivity, and we agree to cooperate enthusiastically with them in production. So we will do our bit of helping productivity. They will do their bit by investing and sharing some of the fruits of their investment. So that's the best we can do in capitalism. But somebody says, well, why do we have to accept the premise? Why do we have to stay in capitalism? If we'd be better off in some alternative way of organizing economic relations, why not go for it? Well, Shavorsky's trying to explain in his transition cost argument why, if material interests are the motivation for transforming the system, if that's the reason you want to do it, because of these antagonisms of material interests, why, in general, it will not be rational for workers to struggle for capitalism, for socialism, as for a rupture for socialism. That way of thinking about the transformation will not be in their interests. And the basic argument is shown in this picture at the bottom. The picture has four different critical curves. So first, there's a curve of what life would be like for workers under capitalism. Now, the way this picture is drawn, capitalism slowly improves the material welfare of workers over time. You can change the shape of this curve and make it stagnant, that the future for workers is about the same as it is now. You can even make it downward, that the future for workers is worse than the way it is now. You can see that as you pull the capitalism curve downward, the transition trough gets smaller and shorter. But unless the future for capitalism plunges, there still is a transition trough. The material welfare of workers in capitalism in the developed capitalist countries, even though there's been a stagnation of wages, has been improving. The material conditions of workers today are better than 30 years ago. By every measure of just the real standard of living, even though wages have been pretty stagnant. And there's a variety of reasons for that, which we could explore. But we have not yet entered an era where the actual material standards of living have declined significantly for the median workers. What's happened is that it's become more dispersed, so there are more people, a higher proportion of the people whose standard of living is half the median than used to be the case. So relative deprivations have unquestionably declined, and I believe it's at around the 20th percentile that the real material standards of living have declined. So if you look at the list of consumption goods that would define the real material standard of living, that's deteriorated for people in the bottom quintile. It hasn't deteriorated at the median in terms of, I mean, do you understand that point? That if you look at whatever measure, make your list of things people consume. So the per capita square feet of living space. So you live in an apartment or a house and you have a certain amount of space. Has the amount of space per person gone up or down? You look at the consumption capital goods, refrigerators, dishwashers, televisions has the quality and size, in the case of televisions, gone up or down? It's gone up. The median television of a person in the United States today is way better than it was 30 years ago. Now, a lot of that's just because of the technical changes, but in terms of asking the question, has the material standard of living changed? The technical improvement in the quality of these things is one of the things that affects your standard of living. The fact that these are being produced so much more productively means that they're cheaper, so that even with stagnant wages, people are able to afford things that they couldn't afford today. A big, a 40-inch television today costs way less in real terms than a small color television did 30 years ago. So these are complicated matters, but the material interests of workers are not of, and when I say of workers, I mean of the median worker, the worker in the middle. The trajectory in this picture is not, it's not so far off of what it has been, but you could flatten it out a bit and it would tell the same story. Okay. The key thing in this picture are the dashed lines relative to the straight line. The top dashed line is what I call the socialist fantasy path. That's the view that if we begin a ruptural struggle for socialism, where we actually have sufficient power to accomplish it, so it's not just a small leftist sectarian group announcing, yes, socialist revolution, it's a mass movement capable of winning political power to launch the dismantling of capitalism and the building of an alternative. So the fantasy path is that as soon as you begin that project in earnest, in a way that has credibility, things get better. There's no transition cost. That's, I say, the fantasy path, because certainly in complex developed societies, it's inconceivable that a major effort at transforming the fundamental structures of power around the economy wouldn't be disruptive in ways that would make for hardship. Now, it's possible one can imagine in very poor countries with relatively fragile states and ultimately relatively weak dominant classes that you could have a seizure of power and a very rapid appropriation of their capacity to produce, where almost instantly the condition of life for most people improves, because you could accomplish a huge improvement in the conditions of life with simple redistributive mechanisms even before you fully establish the alternative institutions for organizing the economy. So that's conceivable. It's certainly not, though, I think, in developed and complex industrial economies. So really the alternatives are something like the socialism optimistic path and the socialism pessimistic path. So the optimistic path is the path that people who support socialism believe in, namely that there are costs to transition. Life does become tougher for the people who eventually benefit in the transition process. But eventually, socialism actually improves the material conditions of life of people, of the vast majority of people, and certainly of the median person in the working class. The pessimism path, which is the path predicted by defenders of capitalism, is that the threat of socialism, when it becomes serious, leads to disinvestment and the flight of capital and the disorganization of capitalist production, but it's never able to reconstruct the economy in a functioning way that would raise standards of living and improve the material conditions of life of people. And so socialism is just a path to ruin. Right? And of course, this is a sharp political debate between people who believe in the optimistic and people who believe in the pessimistic path. Okay, so here's the basic story about the impossibility of the transition to socialism. You develop sufficient solidarity, sufficient mobilizing capacity to pose a credible threat to capitalism. You win elections and set in motion a transition program. The transition program has steps. It's not instantaneous. So you announce that you're going to do certain things. You might immediately nationalize the banks and freeze the assets in the banks, but you can't immediately nationalize all production because you don't have the personnel to run the, who are willing to cooperate with you. You know, you can't just do it. You can't snap your fingers and have it done. So you announce a process, and then the question is, what happens? Well, what happens is capitalists disinvest. They move as much capital as they can abroad. They engage in all sorts of practices, even if they refrain from, counter-revolution. So we're even assuming the most benevolent conditions, that they abide by the rules of the game, the democratic game. They don't launch a military coup or something. We just assume that they're prepared to play by the democratic rules. So they produce a transition trough through their actions. In the initial part of the transition, the socialism pessimistic trough path and the optimistic path look rather similar. In the first part of the transition, they both predict a decline of material conditions of life. But then the question is, how long is this transition? If we're talking about decades for the transition, if it's going to be two election cycles before you hit bottom and begin the improvement, it means that the socialist project has to withstand electoral challenges under democratic conditions on two cycles while conditions get worse and worse. And the pro-capitalist political parties are continually announcing that this is because of the socialist project itself. And the socialists keep saying it's because of capitalist sabotage and eventually things will get better. Well, the question is the solidarity of the supporters of a socialist project likely to be sufficiently robust as to withstand a couple of electoral cycles where conditions are getting worse and worse, and you're getting different predictions about uncertain futures, the optimistic prediction by the defenders of socialism and the pessimistic defenders by their critics. Chvorsky basically argues that it's implausible that such an electoral coalition would remain intact sufficiently strongly to weather the transition, even if the democratic rules of the game remain stable. So even if they don't face the problem of armed insurrection by the supporters of the bourgeoisie, so even if that doesn't happen, so we're abstracting away from that problem, the solidarity will be insufficient to weather the storm of the transition. There'll be defections. And the coalition that supported the original move will fall apart. The solidarity will never be sufficiently strong to go all the way over a long enough period of time. And therefore, at some point, there's the following juncture is reached. Either the socialist project has to abandon its democratic commitments. It has to change the democratic rules of the game, cancel elections, jail the opposition leadership, repress political opposition. Either it abandons the democratic form, or it abandons the socialist path. And that will be an inescapable choice. That's the prediction, that you can't make a transition between capitalism and socialism through democratic means in a ruptural manner under conditions of capitalism. Can't do it. You either have to abandon democracy or abandon the path. Well, if you've abandoned the path, then of course you've abandoned the path and it is no longer a transition to socialism. The question then is, at that point, if you abandon democracy, by democracy I mean liberal, democratic, free elections, free press, opposition allowed, you know, all the usual ingredients of conventional democracy. The question then is, if you abandon democracy, have you also in effect abandoned the socialist path? Because if you abandon democracy, the destination you end up with isn't socialism, it's authoritarian statism. Chvorsky basically argues that so long as the interests that workers pursue in moving towards socialism are primarily the material well-being of workers. That's the purpose. You'll never get sufficient solidarity to survive the transition. So then the question is, well, are there other motives that people can have that could provide sufficient solidarity to survive the transition? So for example, one could imagine, if you take my list of values, there's equality, democracy, community, and sustainability. The equality one is the one that's the most difficult here, because the equality one is the one where equal access to the material conditions to live a flourishing life is the key idea. And what's happening in the transition is that the material conditions to live a flourishing life are collapsing. So it's being called into question, well, why do we want equal access to crappy material conditions of life? You know, capitalism provided better material conditions of life. But it's possible that on the democracy value and the community value, there are immediate gains. That the democracy value is immediately enhanced by the move towards socialism. That the opportunities and possibilities for people to directly participate in democratic processes proliferate right from the start, that there's no transition costs. It's not that you have a decline of democracy and then an increase. You immediately have an increase of democracy. So it's possible on that value, things improve right away. It's possible on the community values, the sense that we're all in this together, that we are building a world that we want to live in, that we live in a world of reciprocities rather than individual competitive selfishness, that those communitarian values are immediately improved. So it's possible that there are these non-purely material values that have these other qualities that improve right away without a transition cost. But then what Jaworski basically argues, and this I think is perhaps, I agree with his argument, but I think it's the place where his arguments could be challenged. He argues that these non-material interests will never be robust enough and durable enough to survive when they go against material interests repeatedly, over a long period of time, over a sufficiently long period of time. They will never be the basis for a strong majoritarian coalition. There'll be just too many fractures in it that will be caused by the combination of the material deprivations and the fact that the material interests in that coalition are not homogeneous. That's why in my discussion of this, I distinguish between the problem that middle class and working class people face with respect to the transition trough and how that adds to the complexity here, so that you get fracturing along the material interests dimension, as well as the difficulty of sustaining the non-material interests. Now, the reason why Jaworski, this part of his argument, may be more vulnerable is that we observe all the time groups of people acting against their material interests for very long periods of time, through many electoral cycles. And we're living in such a world right now. I mean, the New York Times had this interesting article a few weeks ago about the 254 poorest counties in the United States. 211 of them, I think, voted a majority for Romney in the last election. And the poorest of them all was the county that had the highest proportion margin of victory for Romney, apparently. He got 80% of the vote. And half the population in that county are either on food stamps or eligible for food stamps. And the congressman representing them is one of the people most aggressively trying to eliminate the food stamp program. Now, does not compute, that is just palpable proof that people are prepared robustly over time to support political movements because they feel it represents their identities or their values other than their material interests. Now, it could be that the people just have screwy views of what it takes to satisfy their material interests. So there is a view, which some people hold, that the state is the primary reason why the poor remain poor because it blocks all sorts of positive initiatives that would otherwise occur. Right? So part of the Tea Party libertarian view is not just that a rising tide lifts all boats, but that state interference blocks the ability of entrepreneurs to act in poor communities and from poor communities in ways that would generate endogenous benefits for them. So, you know, there's all sorts of versions of that. So I don't know the extent to which when the white population of that poor county in Appalachia in Kentucky vote overwhelmingly for Romney and for congressmen who want to cut the food stamps on which their families depend, whether it's because they are voting on the basis of completely non-material interests, you know, social conservative evangelical beliefs, or because they're deeply confused about what is in their material interests. Both could be in play, and I don't know the answer to that. So that's the part of Szaborski's argument that transition is impossible, the part of it that hinges on the claim that non-material interests could never be sufficiently robust to withstand several electoral cycles because of the centrality of material interests. That's potentially vulnerable. But I think only potentially vulnerable. It does seem to me plausible. Okay, that's the transition cost theory. We have class compromise thesis and the transition cost thesis. Let's take our break and return by 10 after for discussion.